the activities of Maryam Rajavi, who was leading NKO. The French government ordered the arrest of her and her companions, who were operating and living around Paris. They were detained by the French anti-terrorism police. At this time, dozens of NKO members set themselves on fire and many of them died. Some of the self-immolation survivors later spoke with French media and said they were forced to commit this act. The organization ordered its members to set themselves on fire in protest to Maryam Rajavi's arrest and told them that they would put the fires out. But that's not what happened.
In talking espionage and sabotage, there's room to talk of fake news the MKO creates and spreads online using data banks and media robots to create dissent in Iran. They have snug bases in Albania and France from whence to do this. Back in June 2019, Hossein argued that Heshmat Alavi, who wrote dozens of articles for right-wing outlets, appears not to exist. Alavi's persona is a propaganda operation run by the MEK cult. He said Heshmat Alavi is a person used by the MEK or MKO to continue its public relations work in Western countries, aiming to sway elite and public opinion by placing news articles and running social media campaigns, promoting its vision for itself as the future government of Iran. Do comment on the cyber war against Iran, the bots the Munafiqeen are employing, the false news they are spreading, and the way Israel is sort of confirming that news.
What is known as bots or unverifiable accounts are essentially cyber units controlled by Western countries. Before getting into this topic, I must say that the majority of these cyber units or bots are controlled by security and intelligence agencies of Western countries. For example, the Pentagon has a special unit that directly guides these bots, or the Israeli intelligence agency fully controls them. And in Saudi Arabia, they are also controlled by its intelligence agency. And in Europe, these bots are also guided by intelligence organizations. These bots are basically the soldiers of the hybrid cyber war.
Now, how do you get by without money? Olsi Azeshi, a Canadian-Albanian historian, has argued that Saudi Arabia is funding the MEK cult. Perhaps the U.S. and Israel imagine they are leaving no fingerprints behind if they don't spend good money on an ex-terrorist organization. Saudis have done such a thing with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, and we should not be surprised if they pay the MEK bill as well, he added.
Groups like the MKO or Al-Ahwaziyya or others are the same groups that were active in the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. They are operating with the same objectives, and those elements that support them are still the same. Their agenda has also remained unchanged, which is to divide Iran based on what the U.S. had in mind and separate the country into several tiles and break up the Middle East into new sections. Their agenda is exactly what Condoleezza Rice said in 2012, which is for the Middle East to have a new birth. However, the result was the emergence of a resistance in the region.
Members of Al-Ahwaziyya visited Saudi Arabia annually under the guise of Hajj to carry out the plans dictated by the Saudi intelligence agency. These plans included actions against innocent citizens of Iran. All said beggars the question how it would feel if Iran supported terror groups on European home soil, say in France. Earlier, I used the word ex-terrorist for the MEK or MKO. Well, they are no longer designated terrorists as far as the US and allies are concerned. But as we speak, they could be committing any crime anywhere in Europe. Here's a German example.
Naturally, the MKO has many cases of proven crimes in the EU. For example, in Germany, they used to gather money and aids in the name of the children of the MKO families who had lost their parents. But later in the court, it was proven that this group has used this money and aid for buying arms for their members in Iraq so that they can fight Iranian government alongside with Saddam.
To Iran, worse than supporting the MEK cult can only be supporting separatists. Al-Ahwaziyya, which aims to separate Iran's Khuzestan province, killed 25 and injured some 70 during a 2018 military parade in Ahwaz. Of the 25, half were IRGC and half civilian bystanders. Kazem Gharibabadi, secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, said that Sweden has long sponsored anti-Iran terrorist groups and that it was the SMLA or Alahwazia terrorist group's primary stronghold. The group's ringleader, Habib Farajullah Chab, also known as Habib Aysud, received considerable assistance from the Swedish Secret Service, together with his companions. What could that be for other than espionage in return? Even when Habib Aysud was arrested at the request of the Iran Interpol in one of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region, the Swedes intervened immediately and returned him to Sweden on a private flight. Sweden has also been home to members of the terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, MKO, Gharibabadi added. Chab has been held in Iran since 2020, however, and faced trial in 2021.
European governments currently view their interests in alignment with allowing these people to stay in Europe. However, these governments are not taking care of their citizens' security and have not pursued these people based on their dangerous history and backgrounds. It seems due to political interests, similar to those like in Sweden, these countries don't carry out investigations into the crimes and allegations made by members of this organization against one another. There are no efforts to revoke their citizenship or expel them from the country. Governments have not tried to find out what really happened with these members in order to protect their citizens against these dangerous people.
Three members of the anti-Iran separatist terrorist group Alahwazia were found guilty by a Danish court. The three men were convicted of financing and supporting terrorist activities in Iran in collaboration with Saudi Arabia's intelligence services, as well as engaging in espionage activities. The Danish media outlet Ritzo reported. They face years in jail, up to 12 years, for numerous offenses, including providing information about Danish and foreign organizations and individuals to the Saudi Arabian intelligence service.
Alahwazia group is a sellout group that is controlled by the Saudi Arabia intelligence agency, and naturally, wherever they exist, they collect information and intelligence. A portion of the intelligence collected pertains to important government documents of Denmark for Saudi Arabia. This has caught the attention of the government of Denmark. It's a warning for European countries that when they provide shelter and resources for these terrorist groups, in the long run, it becomes dangerous for those countries. However, these nations have no authority to act on these groups because they are controlled by Mossad and the CIA.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week, and bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new study published in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that keeping global warming below the key 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold by the end of the century will require not just halting the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also shutting down many existing sites. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Study warns many fossil fuel sites must be shut down to avert climate disaster. Here's more. A new study published recently in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that keeping global warming below the key 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold by the end of the century will require not just halting the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also shutting down many existing sites. Led by Kelly Trout of Oil Exchange International, the study estimates that 40% of fossil fuel reserves at currently operational development sites across the globe must be left in the ground if the world is to have a 50-50 chance of adequately slashing carbon emissions and limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or below. If fossil fuel reserves at existing sites are extracted, their researchers find nations will substantially exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius carbon budget that corporations and governments are already burning through at an unsustainable clip. The paper, which relies on a commercial model of the world's 25,000 oil and gas fields, leaves unanswered the question of precisely which existing development sites should be shut down, noting that it requires considerations of equity and of the best mechanisms to manage a just transition away from fossil fuel jobs and revenues within and between countries. One recent analysis suggests that some of the largest fossil fuel companies in the world are planning or already operating more than 190 carbon bombs, huge oil and gas projects that could unleash nearly 650 billion tons of CO2 emissions and doom efforts to avert climate catastrophe. Our findings show that halting new extraction projects is a necessary step, but is still not enough to stay within our rapidly dwindling carbon budget, said Greg Mutich of the International Institute for Sustainable Development, a co-author of the new study, adding some existing fossil fuel licenses and production will need to be revoked and phased out early. Mutich added governments need to start tackling head-on how to do this in a fair and equitable way, which will require overcoming opposition from fossil fuel interests. The research comes as the fossil fuel industry is exploiting to lobby for new fossil fuel development. In late March, the Biden administration pledged to ramp up U.S. gas exports to European Union members as they attempt to wean themselves off of Russian fossil fuels. Climate advocates warned that the White House's initiative would likely spur the construction of new pipelines and other fossil fuel infrastructure, potentially locking in more planet-warming pollution, as scientists say emissions must be halved by 2030. Our study reinforces that building new fossil fuel infrastructure is not a viable response to the conflict in Eastern Europe, said Trout, Oil Change International Research Co-Director, adding, the world has already tapped too much oil, gas, and coal. Developing more would either cause more dangerous levels of warming if fully extracted or create a larger scale of standard assets. Therese van der Graaf of Ghent University in Belgium, a study co-author, similarly cautioned that each new coal mine, gas well, or oil field that is developed deepens political entanglement with the fossil fuel industry. Increasing the scale of extraction-related jobs and investments, he added, only makes it harder for governments to manage.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down. I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Now, how insane can you be and still become president of the United States? Many thought and still believe that Donald Trump is crazy. Clinton was labeled a narcissist, Nixon paranoid, and Theodore Roosevelt bipolar. John F. Kennedy was said to have psychopathic traits, and Abraham Lincoln experienced suicidal depression. Now, with Joe Biden trying to shake hands with an invisible being, calling his vice president the president and first lady, the White House had to send the Easter Bunny to save Biden from saying something crazy. Anything can happen in America these days. While questioning the sanity of Biden, one starts to think if any president was sane going into the White House in the first place.
Cuckoo's Nest, a.k.a. the White House.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll discuss the mental state of the U.S. president. What are the conditions for a president to be deemed unfit to carry out his duties? What do the American public think about the president's mental stability? And what will happen if the president is unfit for the job, and who decides if he is or is not? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our program, David Cadillo, Director of Education for the Center for Political Innovation and founder of San Angelo Solidarity from San Angelo, Texas, and Dr. Rick Stagenborg, retired psychiatrist and political activist, joining us out of Oregon. Stay tuned.
In 2006, a study conducted by the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease concluded that half of the U.S. presidents between 1776 and 1974 were mentally ill. Half of the mentally ill were depressed, including James Madison, Dwight Eisenhower, and notably Abraham Lincoln, who was also believed to suffer from psychosis. 20% were alcoholics, which includes Richard Nixon, whose staff struggled so he wouldn't make important decisions in the evenings. Another study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology from 2012 concluded that JFK was a psychopath, but added that certain features of psychopathy are tied to successful interpersonal behavior.
Now, as American mental health concerns are on the rise, and according to a survey by the CBS Health and Morning Consult, about 60% of Americans experience concerns about their own mental health or of family and friends. The mental state of the person running the country is also a subject of discussion. According to a Morning Consult November poll, 50% of voters surveyed disagreed that Joe Biden is in good health. So can you explain the question of mental stability of U.S. presidents going on today in America?
It's actually very interesting. I did some research into the topic, and it seems that many presidents over the years have had their mental stability called into question, but never to the extent we're seeing now over the past two administrations. It's literally night and day. Even George Washington himself, the founder of our country, had his mental stability called into question, but that's something you don't learn about or something that isn't widely talked about. But these things are much more overblown than they have been in the past, and I think that really has to do with the extreme polarization that we've been seeing in America today. No longer can you have a general conversation with somebody without it becoming so extremely political charged in one direction or the other that name calling and slurs of any sort are the obvious outcome whenever all rational debate goes out the window. So you're going to have these little spits and spats. And I think that's what has caused the recent uptick in the question of mental stability.
Now, President Joe Biden, when elected, was asked about potential fundamental disagreements with his vice president and said that he'll come up with some disease and resign, although he did not specify if he meant that he'll have to resign or Kamala Harris, but it doesn't seem to be difficult for him to come up with a disease. Now, in that morning consult November poll we told you about, 48% of voters surveyed believe that Joe Biden is not mentally fit. And before Donald Trump, were there other cases of presidents believed to be unfit to serve in the U.S. high office?
Yes, there have been a couple of cases at least. Woodrow Wilson suffered a massive stroke, and the evidence shows that his wife was probably in charge of the White House at that time. And then there was Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't die immediately after his stroke, and there's some question of who was running the White House for a while before he died. There was not a transfer of power at that time, but I guess now that I think about it, I couldn't swear to that last one, sorry. But yeah, this is the first time since then, for sure. There was some speculation, of course, during the Reagan years, and he actually did turn out to be in the early stages of dementia, but nothing like this, where there was official questioning in some quarters.
Even though the United States has never been short of crazy presidents, and U.S. politicians call each other crazy all the time, the situation seems as though it's becoming worse.
I walked into the cabinet room. You had the group, Crying Chuck, Crazy Nancy. I tell you what, I've been watching her, and I have been watching her for a long period of time. She's not the same person. She's lost it. It was sad when I watched Nancy all moving, the movement and the hands and the craziness. And I watched it. That's, by the way, a person that's got some problems. I'm an extremely stable genius.
The president is old. Donald Trump was the oldest president at 70 years of age when he took office. And just 4 years later, Joe Biden broke his record while being 78 years old when he was inaugurated.
Well, when we talk about the age of presidents, we have to look it back at what past presidents have done in regards to the issues of aging presidents and the questions of their mental stability. During the Carter administration in 1944, they actually attempted to create a mental health monitoring agency for the president of the United States, which would do routine evaluations to see if the president's mental stability was still in a fit state. But as we know now, that commission never got its legs and has not become an official part of the U.S. government's system of checking a president, making sure that everything is up to code, everything's what the people desire. Now the only check in that regard is the campaign trail and the performance in office.
Above all, Joe Biden has been caught on camera trying to shake hands with an invisible being. The State Department and the White House were on occasion forced to clarify Biden's words and statements, calling them his own personal views and not the policy of the administration. Biden has also referred to Vice President Kamala Harris as the president and at another time the first lady. He also called Michelle Obama the vice president. Just recently, the Easter Bunny had to rescue Biden and take him away when he was asked the question by a reporter at the White House Easter egg roll.
The bigger question is who makes those decisions in the first place? Is he just reading off somebody else's script or not? And I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, of course, because the president does speak off... sometimes not off a teleprompter. He's famous for making gaffes, even when his mental faculties were not in question. But the kind of things he's saying now are very dangerous, and really you wouldn't expect a person with his background to say. They're not gaffes. They're incredibly hard to explain after the fact. And this is a perfect example. I mean... calling for essentially calling for the overthrow of another government when he pretends that the United States is not into regime change is a crazy misstatement for somebody with all his faculties.
The divide in the U.S. is becoming larger and the political establishment weaker and less fit to govern. With two consecutive presidents being constantly called crazy, and pressure has been increasing from the public and other politicians for them to step down or have the 25th Amendment to be invoked. Now, these calls were especially done during the time of Donald Trump, where many felt that he was dangerous and should not have the power over the nuclear bomb.
The 25th Amendment clearly states that if a president is physically incapacitated, mentally incapacitated, or deceased, that it would go into a line of succession, starting with the vice president, then going on to the Senate majority leader, and then yada, yada, yada down the line. And I think those are things that are seriously need to be used. There is a reason that these mechanisms were put inside of the Constitution, and it is to weed out these sort of mentally unstable applicants, no matter how that be. And I know, especially when, and nowadays when talking about the field of mental health and mental stability, it's so politically charged that you can't touch it with a 10-foot stick without somebody calling you some sort of hater of disabled people or some things. But these are very serious issues. And as somebody who knows many people who have struggled with mental health issues, I think it's very serious that we take these topics and not brush them aside, because we need to be seriously asking, are these people mentally fit? Are they stable enough to be able to go and lead this country, the second largest economy in the world? It's not taking over to drive my car or something. This is taking over the keys to a huge, massive military, economic superpower.
The 25th Amendment has been put in place so when the president is removed, dies or resigns, he would be replaced by the vice president. Also, when the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress declare that the president is unable to carry out the duties of the office, the president might be removed from power through a process and replaced by the vice president.
A really hypothetical situation. I think it's incredibly unlikely that that's going to happen. If it did, it would probably be a political reason, such as if Biden suddenly got so demented that he started talking peace in Ukraine, then they might do something like that. And it's hard telling what the deep state would be willing to do at that point. They've proven that they'll do whatever it takes to keep themselves in power. And we saw that during the Kennedy administration. We saw that when they got rid of Carter with the October surprise. There's many, many examples that they'll do what it takes.
Some conservatives like TV host and political commentator Tucker Carlson have asked that the 25th Amendment be invoked because of Biden's cognitive decline. He has said that Biden, who is 79, cannot control his emotions due to his age and that his behavior is more dangerous than the one of Trump's.
Focus on this man, what he's doing, that no president has ever done. No president.
No, I haven't taken a test. Why the hell would I take a test? Come on, man. That's like saying you, before you got in this program, if you take a test where you're taking cocaine or not, what do you think, huh? Are you a junkie?
What are you saying?
I'm not out of time. You spoke over time, and I'm going to talk. Here's the deal. Here's the deal. The fact of the matter is, look at what's happening here.
Well, that's not true. You're saying things you do not know what you're talking about. No one said that. Who said that?
Who said that?
You said I set up my son to work in an oil company. Isn't that what you said? Get your words straight, Jack.
Now, Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward has said that a crazy president could on his own trigger a nuclear war. He says that the country needs to perform the operation of the 25th Amendment because in 2020, the military feared that an unstable Donald Trump was about to order a nuclear strike on China. So are key decisions being made by unstable and unfit presidents?
You know, I think when we talk about who's making the key decisions through the State Department, through the presidency, we can clearly see a pattern growing throughout most U.S. presidents in our modern era, especially. It's that they service imperialism and they service the forces of the State Department that a lot of us would call the deep state. And saying this phrase, the deep state, it's people say, oh, it's just some conspiratorial nonsense that's going on. But when you really think about it, it is just the positions inside of the U.S. State Department in which do not require elected officials to hand out those positions. There are people who move up through the ladder over and over, year after year, the revolving doors from different ABC alphabet government agencies through high paid Raytheon, New York Times, you name it. These places are just revolving doors for imperialism, and the powers that be will be pushing through their agenda, whether it be a red person in the White House or a blue person in the White House. So,
in 2017, forensic psychiatrist and president of the World Mental Health Coalition, Bandy X. Lee, edited a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which is essays warning about the dangers of Trump's mental instability and that his psychological problems make him dangerous. Dr. Lee's teaching position at Yale University was terminated in 2020, since according to the university, Lee broke the Goldwater Rule. What are the implications of an unstable president?
The implications, I'm sure I don't have to tell anyone listening to this program, would be absolutely disastrous, potentially. The nuclear codes can be activated by the president at a few minutes' notice. I heard this growing up a lot in schools. 1 minute, a president could be sitting in his Oval Office, White House office, and then 3 minutes later, he could walk outside and launch nuclear weapons at any place in the entire world. And that is real power that the president of the United States holds. And if we're not making sure that that power is kept under the correct hands, we're essentially playing with a lighter inside of a match factory. We're playing with something we know has extremely deadly power, and yet we're just not having the proper precautions to be able to dole out and make sure there's restraints on this power.
Republican pollster Neil Newhouse has noted that an impacting factor in Biden's low approval ratings is his clear difficulties in communicating. He reiterated that the president is losing support in black voters, who are his most loyal Democratic segment of the electorate. When asked if she would support Biden in 2024, one respondent joked, "If he's alive."
It's a little hard to tell. You have to really examine people serially to see how much difference there is. With Trump, from what I've seen, it's a little harder to tell whether he had any deterioration. He wasn't terribly swift in the first place. And Biden, while he's no intellectual giant, he certainly was better organized in the way he presented himself and the way he spoke a decade ago than he is now. But he's also doing much better than he did during the campaign. Now, people have to realize that during a campaign, it's an exhausting schedule. And for most people of that age, they would show some cognitive deficits. I would, and I'm younger than him. I know when I get fatigued, I have some problems with memory and articulation and word finding. For somebody of his age, it's a bigger problem. Not for everybody. I mean, we all know people in their 90s who are sharp as a tack.
Now, it's unclear how crazy or mentally ill you have to be before you're considered unfit for the office of the President of the United States. But given the mental state of many U.S. presidents, and that many believe that the president is more of an actor than an actual decision maker, it seems that the question shouldn't be about a president being unfit to carry out his duties because of his mental illness, but quite the opposite. How crazy must one be to be able or allowed to become president of the United States? And now it's time we see what Abbas Montarim has prepared for us.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we're going to take a look at the facade of the Democrats and Joe Biden being seen as quote-unquote less evil in comparison to Donald Trump and the Republicans. You know, it's no secret that in the 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden was seen as the less evil choice and that he was so much of a better option than Donald Trump. And it's very clear that both of them have some type of mental disorders. I mean, white supremacy itself has got to be considered as some form of psychosis, as literally they think they're superior to black people and people of color, which is just comical. But anyway, why is it that Biden is seen as better than Trump? Is it because he's less outwardly racist? Is it because he isn't as overtly and loudly fascist like Donald Trump? The last time I checked, a fascist is still a fascist. And we have to call Biden exactly what he is, which is a white settler and an imperialist. And his policies from his administration are wreaking havoc on the world. And it's funny that people think that Biden and the Democrats are somehow less racist. And people sometimes have the nerve to utter the word progressive in reference to Biden and the Democrats. But in reality, Joe Biden and the Democratic Party, they are neoliberals, which is a conservative right-wing ideology, which was actually popularized by none other than the devil himself, Ronald Reagan. It's the same Ronald Reagan that is responsible for the student loan crisis that we're in today. The same Ronald Reagan who was part of the war on the Black Panther Party. And this is the ideology. Neoliberalism is the ideology of Joe Biden and the Democrats. Yet election year after election year, we are told to vote for whoever the blue person put in front of us. And that is the better option than the Republicans. And if we look at Joe Biden's presidency, he has expanded the police state by encouraging states and localities to use the $350 billion granted to them in the COVID-19 relief package to hire more cops. And the last time I checked, COVID is a virus. And when do cops stop a virus? And instead of building hospitals and improving healthcare and hiring doctors, instead the U.S. government, they said they don't care about the people. And the U.S. government, they do exactly what it does, which is build up its police and build up its military infrastructure so it can occupy black and brown communities. And if we look at Biden's military spending, Biden literally outspent Trump last year, and he is currently requesting that Congress pass $33 billion in requested Ukraine funding. Yet hundreds of thousands of people living in America are living houseless on the street. Black people in Flint, Michigan still have lead in the water. But this is the lesser evil in comparison to Trump. Biden and his administration, they'd rather fund a proxy war than help the poor. Biden also approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. He also sold $650 million worth of missiles to Saudi Arabia, which is dropping bombs on the people of Yemen with the help of the U.S. and European allies. And these are just a few examples of Biden's militarism. Yet every single election year, they tell us to vote Democrat. But the way I see it and the way that it is evil is evil, whether it's red or blue. And both the Democrats and Republicans work together for their common interests of settler colonialism and imperialism. And why should we vote for evil? Why should we vote for evil? All this, it really just exposes America for what it is. Because in reality, America is simply a one-party state. And the ones who are in control are the corporations who make billions upon billions of dollars off of exploiting the people. And it's up to the people to make the changes. As it's very clear, it's clear today that both the Republicans and the Democrats are two settler parties and will never be interested in freedom and independence for the people. We must become our own liberators and free the land from Euro-American control. This is Power to the People.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The truth is that as long as the surprising criminal Zionist regime is dominating over Quds, all days of the year should be considered to be Quds Day. Holy Quds is the heart of Palestine, and the entire occupied country of Palestine, from river to the sea, is a continuation of Quds. The Palestinian nation is showing every day that it has stood up and will stand up against the oppressor with an exemplary courage. The Palestinian youth have acted as a defensive shield for the Palestine with their self-sacrificing activities, and they are harbingers of a different future. We are carrying out this year's Quds Day while everything is signaling a new equation in Palestine's present and future.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, an invincible willpower in Palestine and throughout West Asia has replaced the invincible army of the Zionists. Today, that criminal army has been forced to turn its aggressive formation into a defensive one. In the political arena today, the most important supporter of that usurping regime, the United States of America, has suffered consecutive defeats. It has been defeated in the war in Afghanistan, defeated in its maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic of Iran, defeated in the face of Asian powers, defeated in trying to control the economy of the world, and defeated in the internal management of its own country and managing the phenomenon of the deep rift that has come about in the U.S. establishment. The usurping Zionist regime is wallowing in a convoluted network of problems in both political and military arenas. The former butcher and criminal who was at the top of that regime, was thrown into the dustbin of history following the epic at Saif al-Quds. Every hour, his current successors await the sharp blade of another epic.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The controversial idea of creating an EU army has now come to pass in all but name. The European Commission confirmed on Wednesday the bloc's 27 nations have agreed to jointly spend €200 billion on military hardware over the next few years.
Joint procurement is better operationally for our armed forces, because this strengthens the interoperability between the armed forces.
Citizens are struggling to survive, mainly due to the economic fallout from the conflict in Ukraine. But it appears EU authorities have other priorities.
We need modern air defences. We need drones. We need air-to-air refuelling capabilities. We need tanks and armoured vehicles. We need coastal defence.
Anti-war demonstrators in Brussels say the extra billions being spent on NATO and the EU army cannot be justified.
Just those people are saying that we have to secure ourselves. Against who? Against what? Against, I don't know.
We want Belgium out of NATO, and we want NATO out of Belgium.
The European Commission insists the EU's military spending plan will complement the work of NATO, not erode it. But military experts are saying that is inevitable. And they say the project has already seriously undermined NATO's credibility. The Commission has also just announced an additional €9 billion for the Ukrainian government.
Since the beginning of Russia's aggression on 24th of February, the EU has provided €4.1 billion to help Ukraine.
Hard-pressed EU taxpayers might wonder how the money will be spent. Last September, the bloc's financial watchdog revealed how corruption is rife in Ukraine at every level, from the government to the judiciary. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one, to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even... saving, now you got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up, petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing one in two people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Saeed Purza, London.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol, and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible increases and disconcerting increases in anxiety, stress, depression, burnouts.
Some analysts suggest untold misery is being piled on citizens because the West purposely ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns. We have been seeking opinions on the current economic pressures.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
It will go until the point where people understand, okay, this is the peak, we cannot do anymore, and then let's see what's happened. I don't know.
Not only the energy, but the prices of food, the prices of transport. So everything is much more higher.
Driving the EU's foreign policy, critics say Washington has put the bloc in an unwinnable situation. There was no mention of that by key speakers at the Brussels conference.
Thanks to our unity, we have seen that swift and sweeping sanctions can have enormous force.
Enormous force for who? Russia's currency, the ruble, is doing very well, and the Federation is benefiting from rising energy prices. Experts warn of catastrophe if the Kremlin decides to cut off its gas supplies to the EU. As one contributor at the Brussels Economic Forum put it, there is no economy without energy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akla, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
Final results of Lebanon's parliamentary elections are out, with Hezbollah and its allies securing at least half of the seats in the legislative body. The Minister of Interior stressed that the election process was complex and difficult, but free and fair.
With regards to the percentage of voters and the population of Lebanon and the circumstances surrounding the elections, it was a successful election and can be considered a significant achievement. The incidents which took place are marginal and very few in relation to the number of districts and polling stations and ballot boxes, which were around 6,900. These elections were fair and credible.
Despite the political silence during the declaration of the results, analysts believe commotion is yet to come.
Despite of the results, which are almost a tie, I believe that